from the legendary Music Row in Nashville, Tennessee, Larrivee Guitars presents two verses in a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino
and the Music Row Show.
Hey, everybody, it's Hino. Welcome back to the Music Row Show, brought to you by Larrivee Guitars. The number to call in is 800-688-9522. And, of course, you can always email us at mail@themusicrowshow.com.
That's all true. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you're just tuning in, you missed a good hour with Pete, our friend Pete Fisher at the Grand Ole Opry. He always has good stories and fun stuff to talk about. Remember, you can always listen to past shows by clicking the podcast page on themusicrowshow.com.
You know, Scott, I'm a little worried now because I already had gas, guitar acquisition syndrome. I really like that little OM that you have. Mm-hmm. And now you're talking about this new SD that's out.
Man.
That you saw over at Guitar Center, the new place that you can get Larrivee guitars.
It's killer.
Now I'm going to have to make room for two new guitars. How is that going to happen? You've seen my house. I don't have room for the ones I have.
Your kids are old enough to move out.
Some of them.
One's four, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's ready. She can handle herself just fine. No, I'm telling you, this guitar is so amazing. That 12, I've never owned a 12 fret.
Yeah, and they're much louder.
It's a louder. It's that slope shoulder dreadnought. It's killer. And it's at our Guitar Center.
You know where I'm going tomorrow. I'm going to go play that right away.
Go get them.
Yeah. So that's why we always say you should definitely check out Larrivee Guitars. Go to their website, larrivee.com, and find out if there's a Guitar Center near you or any other place they carry them, and just go try them out.
Yeah.
Try that new SD. Gosh.
How come you don't have one here?
They're right behind you.
Well, not my slopes. My OM's right there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's my OM.
And the LV09.
So we got a couple here.
Yeah, we do. We keep them on hand.
But the slope show, I'm gonna have to save up a little money for that one.
Yeah,
but I will.
All right,
I'm a big fan of those guitars too.
Well, great. Well, Scott, are you?
Yeah.
Well, in case you're wondering who just said that, Scott's going to introduce him now.
I am. This hour's guest is really a true multitasker. If you read up on him, I mean, when he was playing in his alt-rock band Farmer, he was also working A&R for a major label. And then while he was working A&R for Columbia Records, he was producing some of the last decade's hot new talent. And while he's been producing, he's also writing songs, runs his own studio. I think he's a roofing contractor.
I think so, yeah.
I think he does everything. Okay, not really with the roofing. So no calls about,
kind of shingles. You don't want me doing your roofing. Okay. That much I know.
No, there you go.
But he's good at raising the roof. Ooh, ooh.
Oh. Now, see, when you laugh, that encourages him. Don't laugh. Oh, but it's like, don't look a mean dog in the eye. But he's worked with like Mark Broussard, Kate Vogel, Matt Nathanson, just to name a few. And since moving to Nashville just a little more than a year ago, he's been getting cuts and holds here in the country music world. We have an awful lot to talk about. It's a pleasure to say Marshall Altman, welcome to the Music Row
Show.
Thank
you so much for having me. I was really
glad you're here.
Well, happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you are. We're talking right before we came on. We kind of have something in common. We grew up in the same part of California down there in Huntington Beach. What was it that made you want to give up surfing and do music for a living?
You know, it's funny. I went to college at UC Santa Barbara, so I didn't really have to give up surfing for a while. But I was studying economics of all things, minoring in music there. And
those are polar opposites, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. Minoring in music And had a little epiphany one day and just decided that I didn't want to spend my life doing, unfortunately, what my father wanted me to do. And left school, went to music school, and started delivering pizza. And the rest is history. You know, I'll probably finish delivering pizza, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned you went to school. I understand you went to the Grove School of Music, mm-hmm. which is was a seriously jazz theory kind of place. I did a little bit of study there. How did that affect or shape your pop writing?
You know, the best thing about going to Grove, and I studied composition and arrangement there. I was really a singer. I wasn't a great instrumentalist, so it really forced me to understand how to hear music in my head, really understand what all the instruments were doing. I didn't think I realized it at the time that I was going to be a record producer. My goal had always been to go out and, you know, front a band or just make a living doing music. And when it came time to start writing, I said, I wait a minute, I know how to make that change work here. I know how to make this melody work a little bit better. So the composition and arrangement that I studied there, really in a super challenging way, the theory there was ridiculously hard, really helped me to understand pop music once I got out of my own way, you know. The jazz stuff I learned there, really, it was of no use to me when I was first starting out, because I kept trying to use everything I had learned in writing pop songs and country songs. And really, it's not about that. It's just sometimes you can pull a little piece of information you learn from composition and arrangement and put it in a song, and it really works. The rest of the time, it's just knowing how to play, you know, G, C, D, I think. Right. But
G, C, hold on, I'm going to write that
down.
Yeah,
D. You might want to work on that one.
K, G, A minor.
That maybe you could show us that one during the break.
Just move the capo. Yeah. That's what I do. That's what
okay.
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're touring with your band Farmer back in the day.
Influential West Coast rock band Farmer is how I thought it was supposed to read.
I'm sorry.
Cool.
Inspirational, influential
West Coast
alt rock. Future Hall of Fame member.
Yeah, no, right. That sounds egomaniacal, fella, so I don't have to throw that in there.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, so you're doing that back in the day, but while you're doing that, you're also working as an A&R scout for Capitol Records. I mean, you're kind of working both sides of the fence. How do you straddle that line mentally? I mean, that's just two different thought processes.
It kind of is. You know, it was almost accidental how I got that job. I'd gotten a record deal at a pretty young age. I'd started a studio and was recording people and said, oh, I can write some songs. And I wrote some songs and didn't know anything. Sent out 400 packages to every single A&R person in the A&R registry back in the day. Mm-hmm. And two of the best A&R people in the world ever called me. And I had no idea. I was like, oh, well, it's easy. And I flew to New York and got a record deal. I was like, oh, great. And then you have a studio? You should make your own record. Great. Of course I'll make mine. And I made maybe the worst record in history. that was for Capitol. I met a bunch of people during that process at Capitol, and I'd lost the deal, and I had a little computer background, and I ended up doing some software development for Capitol and met a bunch of people, and then quit that job and became a sales and marketing assistant there and worked my way up and got bored and started a band and got signed to Aware Records with Farmer. And as I was about to go out on the road, I went to a couple of my friends and said, look, why don't you just put me on the payroll? I'll see what's out there. You know, I love music. I was always bringing the A&R staff new music. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you're sort of born an A&R person to a certain extent. You know, I'm sure you guys, you listen to a lot of music. You know what you love. I just had the proximity, the good fortune or the bad fortune, depending on how you look at it, to be in a major label record company and have some relationships with some A&R people that trusted me. And, you know, they paid me a little bit of money, and I looked at stuff, and I found something great.
But how are you finding that when you're on the road playing? I mean, I used to tour, and we never saw any other musicians because we were always gigging. Yeah. So how do you do that?
You know, it was strange. I always wanted to talk about music. I would talk to promoters. I would talk to the doorman. I would talk to the bartender. I talked to the sound guy. I would talk to other musicians about what they were listening to. It's just something I've always done. It's always felt pretty natural to me. I have a little label here in Nashville that I've just started. I'm just about done with my first artist here. It just felt like a natural progression for me as part of, you know, being a musician, finding stuff I loved and then turning my friends onto it. It just so happened that my friends had, you know, A&R jobs at the time, and they were paying me $300 a month. So I was like, I got to get this.
Wow.
It's $300
a month.
I got to get this right.
Well,
yeah.
You know, as far as being an A&R guy, after getting a band signed, how involved is the A&R guy in that artist's career from that point on? Do they wash their hands at that point and just go find somebody else? Or
I think it varies from A&R person to A&R person and from situation to situation. From my perspective, my goal was to find a band, get them signed with as much truth and honesty as I possibly could, meaning lie to them as little as possible.
Keeping it to a minimum.
Yeah, and get them signed and then sort of be their manager inside the record company. I always felt like it was my job to protect them, you know, sometimes from themselves, sometimes from the label, but really to protect them and help them grow as artists. It's such a, you know, one of the things that I one of the things that I always took to heart as an A&R person was that, you know, I know how hard it is to get a record deal. I know how hard it is to get up in the morning and write a song. I know how hard it is to get on stage and try and be great when there's nobody in the room, you know, right. And even when there's a lot of people in the room, sometimes it's hard. So, you know, my perspective was, I need to take care of these bands from beginning to end. That was my perspective. That's not the way it is all over the place. But obviously, I'm not really doing A&R or major labels anymore. So yeah.
No, but you did. You did for 10 years. I mean, after Capitol, you were at Hollywood Records, and then you were at Columbia Records, and it became much more a full-time gig for you.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that out there as we're asking these questions.
Yeah.
So what, in your opinion, what makes a good A&R person?
I think really having the band's interests first makes a great A&R person. I know that sounds counterintuitive, because A&R people work for labels.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the band's music and the band themselves are going to be exploited sometimes positively, sometimes negatively across the board by the label, by promoters, by everybody. There needs to be one person who's inside the label who can say, no, you know, that's not a good fit, or that's not the right show, or that's not the right song, or even, no, you can do better than this. You need to have higher expectations for yourself than this. Mm-hmm. And that's my perspective on what a great A&R person mm-hmm. is. It's sometimes you're the confessor, sometimes you're the motivator, sometimes you're the best friend, sometimes you're the parent.
Well, what advice would you give to somebody who was looking to get into that line of work now and being an A&R person?
Be an A&R person. You don't need a major label job to be an A&R person. There's great music all over the place. Sometimes it's just finding something you love and fostering it. Sometimes that means putting on a house show for a band from another part of the country that you love. Call them. Say you want them to play at your house if they're not big enough to play a club. Sometimes that means saving up a little bit of money and finding something you love and saying, hey, man, let's go record a single. Let's just put it out. Sometimes it means putting musicians together. If you love music, and you have, you know, I mean, seriously, it's a little bit of egomaniacal attitude on my part. Like, I always thought I knew best.
Right.
And sometimes I did and sometimes I didn't. But if you can find a way to really embrace an artist and make them feel like you understand and trust them and get a couple things right, you know, you'll have a shot at really helping them work their career.
But just from a nuts and bolts level, if you're wanting to do that for a living,
oh, to get an
A&R job? You got to make money. How do you do that and make a living at it?
You know, it's so difficult at major labels these days. There's so few people. It's the road in is very, very challenging. You can intern for free. You know, there'll be 200 interns for every assistant job that opens. My suggestion, if you want to be an A&R person, is get a great straight job, get a great day job, save your money, find music you believe in, and put your money where your mouth is. You know, instead of buying a big screen TV or taking a trip to, you know, to the Gulf Coast, find a band you love, find a great recording studio somewhere. It doesn't have to be real expensive, and see if they can make, you know, see if they want to make a record. Make a record. You can put music up on TuneCore. You can get it up on Amazon. You can get it all over the place with as much access and as much speed as Capitol, Sony, Warner Brothers, or Interscope these days. And I really believe if you make great music, people will find it. People will hear it. That's my advice. Be an A&R person is my advice. If you want to be an A&R person, be an A&R person. You don't need a major label job to do it.
And speaking of Gulf Coast, we're going to be at the Frank Brown Songwriters Festival here in a couple of weeks. So, go ahead and make that trip down there.
Good segue. Very nice.
We haven't been down on the Gulf Coast yet. I want to go down there.
Come on.
Awesome.
Well, come on. We got room in the car.
All right.
We're going to be back here with more of Marshall Altman, hit songwriter and producer, here on the Music Row Show. Stick around.
Melody. Stop the car, pulled out the guitar. Half friend in New Orleans said, take me home, home, home.
Yeah. Welcome back to the Music Row Show, brought to you by Larrivé Guitars, and that's home.
Give me a little more. Come on, Tom. Give me a little more.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did not pick my pen up off the paper.
Really?
That song is really weird.
That's awesome. Well, that's a song put out by Mark Broussard and was written by our guest this hour, Marshall Altman. Great tune. So you said you didn't even pick your pen up off the paper. It just came out?
It's one of those, you know, so, happens so infrequently for us as songwriters.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Mark, I was, you know, I produced Mark's first independent album and then was sort of jumping through some hoops to get the second one. And in the interim, he'd sent me a bunch of new songs, and like half the first verse had been written, and the "Take Me Home," that half the first verse, first part of the chorus had been written. And I remember sitting down, my wife and I had just moved into this new house, and I put the headphones on the Discman, old school.
Yeah,
headphones. I might have been a Walkman. I can't remember, but. And I used to have the brown spiral notebook, no lines on the pages. Like Law and Order was on. I sat down and put the headphones on and just, you know, put my – it's a radio, so you can't see what
I did.
Yeah,
you couldn't have seen what it – it was really cool. You guys missed it.
Yeah.
Darn.
But I was like struck by – you know, I was struck by lightning. I think the only time I ever felt like that was when I met my wife. But, my pen did not leave the paper. We made one small change in the lyric. Mark felt like there was one word he couldn't sing. Mm-hmm. And
but the melody and everything just kind of came
the up. Whole second verse, you know, the way the third verse pops. I mean, the whole thing, you know, I just heard the whole thing. It was just
nice.
Yeah. And there's some other great writers on that. Shannon and Drew Ramsey, Shannon, Drew Ramsey, Ted Broussard, Mark Broussard, myself.
Wow. Yeah. So they were all in the room watching Law and Order with you? Or
no, I was by myself. But Mark and Ted came up with a line. Shannon and Drew came up with the beats and some of the lyric.
Oh, cool.
And then I just finished the lyric and the melody off.
I'll tell you, the first time I heard that song, that was one of those almost had to pull over. That last part when it hits, and I was just like, wow, this is something amazing. So I don't say that a lot.
Thank you. That
song. I got one more A&R question for you, because you were talking about when you were first getting started, you sent out copious amounts of packages to anybody you could think of.
I did.
And as once you got into A&R, you were getting copious amounts of things from people. And I've seen packs that have a CD and contact info and maybe a photo, and I've seen some that have, you know, Jolly Jumps and you know, all sorts of stuff. Talk about,
or furry envelopes, anything to stand out.
What you know, if we're trying to get our stuff out there, what are your suggestions?
Listen, the truth of the matter is most A&R people don't listen to unsolicited material. Sometimes it's company policy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just the amount of material that comes in. I can only speak for myself. Actually, I can speak for the community at large. If you send in a crazy package wrapped in fur with some brownies and, you know, a bottle of Jim Beam, nobody's going to listen to your record. They're going to listen to it if only to sort of
laugh,
amuse themselves. Right. Yes. Really, my advice for submitting music is be polite about it. If you're going to send in a CD, make sure your name and contact information is on the CD. If you're going to send in MP3s, be brief. It's the music that matters. It's not about how much your mom loves your songs, how many sets you've played, it's nothing matters except the music. And I've always believed that if an A&R person hears something great and it reaches them, they will reach out. I used to do it all the time. I would listen to as much unsolicited material as I possibly could when I was doing A&R.
Hmm.
And that's just because I remember what it was like
to
send stuff out and get rejection letters. I still have all my rejection letters. Yeah, or hear nothing at all. I was always grateful to get a rejection letter. I still have a packet of about 70 of them.
Nice.
Yeah, I keep them, and I will go through them every now and then.
Is that sort of like a revenge list or something?
You know what? You know, most of those people ended up becoming my friends because I ended up getting the business, and I always thought it was a classy move. I always thought it was something that had heart and integrity to it, to write a note back and say, hey, I'm not feeling this. Good luck, though.
Yeah.
Or, hey, I think there's something here. Keep it up and stay in contact with me. Those were the best. Those were the best notes to get. I mean, aside, right. you know, aside from the two phone calls that I got, which were, "Hey, let's, you should make a record here." You know, all the other ones were really inspiring and encouraging to me.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, how about a song?
Sure.
Feel like playing
I'll play
a song?
A new one. Sure. All right. Let me play a new one. I wrote this with a guy named Jim McCormick, who I've been writing a lot with. Great writer. I don't know if you guys ever get a chance to sit down with him.
All right.
Not yet.
Amazing. Excuse me. And it's called Wildwood. Sorry, it's a little flat, huh? Lisa told me I had perfect pitch, Scott.
Really?
Yeah.
I do.
Maybe she meant baseball.
Oh, yeah, right, right. It's a little chilly out. Guitar gets out of tune. How close should I be to this mic?
Just You're good.
Fine. Right. You're fine.
Sunrise has got me thinking about the wildwood. I never realized one day you'd be gone. I hear your voice calling me from the distance, reminding me of a long forgotten song. Sha la 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 la, I answer. Sha la 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 la, you sing it back. I thought I was a poet to your dancer, but I couldn't write the final act. And the wildwood don't come back. Wildwood, the wildwood. You told me everything you wanted, but I didn't know how to reap what we'd sown. And here's your voice still calling me from the distance, and here I am, wiser but alone. Sha la 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 la, I answer. Sha la 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 la, you sing it back. I tried to be the poet to your dancer, but I couldn't write the final act. And the wildwood won't come back. Wildwood, the wildwood, the wildwood won't come back. Wildwood, the wildwood. Sha la 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 la, I answer. Sha la 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 la, you sing it back. If I ever was the poet to your dancer, baby, please forgive me that. 'Cause the wildwood don't come back. The wildwood don't come back.
Very nice.
Man, I haven't done that since maybe 97, I think.
Really?
I played a song on the radio.
Yeah, well, there you go.
For a long time.
Nice to have you back.
Yeah.
Good to be back, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, you mentioned you have a studio here, and,
yep.
and you had some studios out in California, out in Burbank. How is it different trying to keep a studio going out there versus out here? What are the
It's so expensive.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Out there versus
out
here?
There. Yeah. Out there. You know, I was very, very fortunate. I had, you know, I had a lot of work to do. I'm really lucky for that. I had a lot of work and a lot of great opportunities with great artists to write, to produce records. It was very difficult for me to write, though. It was so expensive. You know, the studio probably was $10,000 a month between utilities, insurance, staff, you know, 10 grand. So $2,500 a week, $500 a day. So if I wanted to take a day to write, it was going to cost me, you know, $400 or $500 just to sit down and not be producing, not generating any income. I mean, I think I did a lot of triage writing, which is basically, you know, writing with the artists that I was working with, helping them fix songs as a producer. And I'm very, very respectful about that. I'm not a guy who's like, hey, that A minor, change it to an A minor 7 and give me 25% of the song. Yeah, I'm not that guy. But, you know, I spent a lot. The most writing I did was, wow, this song is great. Let's rework the arrangement. Let's rewrite the lyric. Let's change the melody. It's so close. I didn't really have a chance to write that often. I think the only real run I had at writing, I wrote with Ingrid Michaelson for 2 weeks in 2009. And we wrote 5 songs in 2 weeks. All of them got cut. We had a number one song out of it in, you know, in the UK and 20 countries around the world, I think. And that was one of the things that really solidified my desire to move here, which was I want to write. You know, I don't want to just write to solve a problem when I'm making a record as a producer.
Right.
I always felt like, you know, I had a voice. I had a voice, not just a singing voice, but a lyrical voice that I felt like I wasn't getting the chance to use. And in addition to moving to Nashville for the great people and being a great place to raise a family and really being the best city in the world to live if you're a musician. And at the end of the day, I'm a musician, just like you guys. You know, in addition to all those things, I knew if I moved here, I would have the chance to write more. And I want to write. So that's one of the reasons I'm here.
Yeah. You touched on something a second ago. What's the difference between a good song and a great song? You were saying, hey, this is a good song. Let's take it one step further.
The difference between a good song and a great song. Well, I've said this a few times before, but if, you know, we're in a room and the ceiling's 10 feet high, a bad song is the floor, right? Mm-hmm. 10 feet away from a bad song is a good song. Right?
Mm-hmm.
A great song is the sun. So, you know, it's 93 million miles minus 10 feet is the difference between good and great, okay, in my opinion. And as a songwriter, you know, I don't even know if I've written a great song yet. I mean, my goal, my hope is to write a great song. You know, when it's all over, somebody can say, Marshall Altman, you know, we're putting him to rest. He wrote 2 great songs in his day. The difference between a good song and a great song in less, you know, less esoteric terms, I think a great song becomes ingrained in the fabric of who you are when you hear it. Mm-hmm. Simply, I don't know what the secret is. If I knew it,
sure,
I'd be
writing those every day. Yeah,
of course. The goal, though, for me is to get up every day and write something great and something true and something real. And now sometimes that's a happy song that doesn't, the lyric doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. You know, this song has some sha-la-las in it. You know, some days that's filling the void for me. Sometimes that's the call that I get, you know, to put in the song. Some days it's a message of pain or hope or, you know, joy or whatever. But every day I get up and try and write. And I try and write something great, knowing more than likely I'm going to fail. But, you know, some days I get a key and I get to unlock something that I didn't know existed before. And the next day when I go to write, I got that key on my key ring and I know how to get through whatever problems in front of me. That's something I tell young writers a lot. It's like songwriting is, you know, you're standing in front of a house trying to get in and the door's locked and you have to use these emotional keys, these emotional cues you've had in your life, your intellect, the things you've read, the experiences you've had, the music you've listened to. Every one of those is a key and you stand in front of this door and you try and open it. And it's a problem. And boom, you open it and you're like, okay, I know how to get through this door now. And every day from that day forward, whatever you write has to be better than the song you wrote yesterday.
Right.
You know, because you've got that key.
Yeah.
You've got that one key. You understand how to get through that door. And hopefully you can open up a door every single day and, you know, write great songs. It doesn't have, you know, as we all know, great songs do not come easy.
Yeah.
But, you know, the great song, it's a part of the fabric of your life the first time you hear it. That's what I think. Oh,
so by the time you're done at the end of your career, you've got a keychain like one of those janitors at a high school. I mean, hopefully.
Exactly.
And they all work.
I've got one, right? Nice. I've got a clip-on one. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I'm locked in the basement. You're listening to The Music Row Show. We're with Marshall Altman. Stick around. We got a lot more. We got your phone calls here after this.
My breath, and I stop to catch your eye. No need to second guess. It's you been on my mind. Will I drift days away, but that's okay. It's like I want to hear silent sound.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show, brought to you by Larrave Guitars, and that's Kate Vogel, excuse me.
Yeah.
That's a cool song, and that's a tune called Only Fooling Yourself, and that was produced by our guest this hour, Marshall Altman.
Great.
Sweet. Now, we're going to go right to the phones here. We got a guy named Curtis. Curtis, welcome to the Music Row Show.
Marshall, that's Curtis Peoples.
Curtis.
Hey.
How you doing, kid? It's good to hear your voice, man. Are you in town?
I know, man. I'm randomly on Twitter. And I see that you posted that, and I was like, I'm calling.
Love it, man. So, well, I know you're
now, how do you know? How do you know Marshall?
Marshall produced my last album, my debut solo record. Marshall, and he put it out on his record label.
Very cool.
Ago.
Yeah.
So how?
Great record.
Back in L.A. I'm a California guy.
Okay. So is he as much of a tyrant to work with as we hear around town? Or?
No, but he is relentless, and he'll work forever, and I love that. because we did the record. Marshall, it was on his label, so he was backing it and making the whole thing happen. So we would work nights because he had worked during the day with other artists, and so I would go in there around 9 o'clock at night. We would write songs and work on the record, and did that for about 6 months, and it was such a great special experience for me.
Yeah, it's a great record too, Curtis.
Right.
Very cool.
I still do that, Curtis. By the way, it hasn't changed.
Hey, Kurt.
I don't either.
Yeah. Kurt, shameless plug. What's your website? How do people hear your music?
CurtisPeoples.com, like CURTIS, people with an S.
All
Very
right.
Cool. Yeah,
all right.
Get it.
Thanks for calling, buddy.
Thanks for
Kurt,
calling,
great
man.
To hear your voice. I'll see you when you get
here. You're the best, Marshall.
You
all
too,
right,
buddy. Thanks for calling.
So I'm curious, as a producer, what's your take on a producer having a sound, that's distinct enough that no matter what artist they record, you can tell who that is. There's some producers who have that. You got your Phil Spectors, Jeff Lynns. When you hear their stuff, it's them.
Yeah, I've always admired those guys, but that is not the way I approach it at all. My perspective as a producer is my job is to understand the artist that I'm working with as much as I can, understand their strengths and their weaknesses, and get inside their head and make a record for them that's the fullest expression of who they are. I don't know if I've made any records that sound the same. I'm sure I have. I'm sure there are people out there who know some of my work and will say, well, this sounds like that. When I used, for a long time, I would use the same 4 or 5 session guys playing, 4 or 5 guys played on 35 records of mine, and not one of them sounds the same, at least to me. I've never approached them the same way. I think, when you want the Phil Spector sound, when you wanted the Phil Spector sound in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, you would go to Phil, and he would give you that thing. Like I said, my perspective on producing is that's not my job. My job is not to make somebody sound like me. My job is to make somebody sound like them.
I just finished reading Keith Richards' book, Life. Great book. And he talks about recording, and he's saying, and of course this is his opinion, saying that, you don't need 18 mics on the drums. You record the room. The trick is finding the right room. One of their albums was done in a basement in a castle,
with
6 microphones. How do you approach the sound as a producer?
As I've gotten better at achieving the sound that I want, I focus on it less and less. And not to say that I don't care how a record sounds, because I do. It's an incredibly important part of the process. I tend to focus on performance more than anything. And that has nothing to do with people listening on earbuds or listening on their computer. I'm not trying to diminish the importance of the sonic quality of an album. Mm-hmm. I just feel like the performance is where the truth lies, not the sound of anything. If you have a great band performing a great song, and it's a bad performance, it's not a good recording. Mm-hmm. People will still love the music. I think the sonic elements that people attach themselves to are something that they discover or fall in love with over the long term of listening to an album. You know, if right. the first thing I love on an album is the snare sound, chances are I'm not really going to want to listen after the third time because right. the snare sound doesn't change. A song, you know, lives and breathes. A vocal performance lives and breathes. A great guitar performance lives and breathes. There's intricacies and dynamics in it that exist and change every single time you listen to it. A snare sound stays the same.
There, we just lost all of our drummer listeners.
Sorry, not to mention a snare sound. And I will tell you this. A great drummer, you know, I've been very fortunate to work with some amazing drummers. They can play the worst kit in the world with the worst mics on it, and it still sounds great.
Yeah.
It's really about performance for me.
Okay.
And again, not to say I'm not looking at the sonics, because sometimes something will be wrong. Things are either wrong or right for me in terms of sound, except for vocals. I feel like there are far more intricacies in the recording of a vocal. I will spend quite a lot of time delving into which mic, which pre, which EQ, where to stand, what to eat, what to drink.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. All right, we got to take one more break. We're going to be back with one last segment with Marshall Altman here on the Music Row Show. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show, brought to you by Larrave Guitars, and that's a tune called Come On, Get Higher, Matt Nathanson, produced by our guest this hour, Marshall Altman.
Thanks again for having me, guys.
Thanks for being here. This has been a fun hour. I really enjoyed it. I read an interview, and we were just kind of talking about this during the break, too, but you had said that you don't think L.A. is a town made for musicians like Nashville is. Can you explain that?
It's definitely not, and not to take anything away from Los Angeles. It was incredibly good to me. I have great friends there. I make great music there. There are great people there, but you know, to survive, to not just survive, to actually thrive, meaning you can have a family, you can take a vacation, you can live in a nice house, your kids can go to a good school. What you do matters, even if you're not at the top of the charts at the moment. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles is not that town. It only matters there if you're at the top, if you're, you know, if you got 10 hits in a row, if you got, you know, the biggest car and, you know, you got two assistants and all that stuff. And not to say there's nothing wrong with that. There, you know, Los Angeles is a great town full of great people. But music has gotten less and less important there. The true soul of music. And this is my perspective. The true soul of what it is that we do, which is get up and create something where there was nothing.
Right.
That has been diminishing in its importance in Los Angeles for a long time, in my perspective. Nashville's such an amazing town to live in as a musician. I can't imagine, now that we live here, I can't imagine living anywhere else. What we do has a value here, whether or not it's the most played song of the year, or it's the least, you know, if you write a great song, if you write a song that moves somebody, it matters here. Our community can survive here, and not just survive, but actually thrive, just doing what they've spent their lives doing, what they've devoted their lives to do. Mm-hmm. I've devoted my life to music. I've passed up on so many opportunities. And to live in a city that I know that values that, even if it's just the people that I get to work with on a day-to-day basis, or the people who, you know, somebody here sees me playing a show, what I do matters here. And I stopped feeling that way about Los Angeles, even though when we left LA, things had never been better when we left Los Angeles. I was sort of at the peak of my career as a producer and as a writer. I mean, I still felt like I had to leave because I didn't want my life to just be about maintaining this pace of, right. you know, well, yeah, you got a number one song, you got another one song, you sold how many millions, right? My life can't just be about how many number one songs I have and how many records I've sold. I have to believe that the music that I've devoted myself to is the most important thing. And sometimes that's going to sell a lot and sometimes it's not.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
We want to definitely thank you for coming and hanging out with us tonight. I mean, it's gone by way too fast.
Yeah, no, I can't believe that was really an hour, or was that clock fast?
Yeah, that's pretty dead on. Yeah,
it's like 11 minutes, right? You speeds fast.
Okay, getting back to one of your first gigs, what's an acceptable tip to the pizza delivery guy? And do you think that in general, people who've delivered pizzas tip better?
When you get to David Hasselhoff's house,
yeah.
don't laugh at him.
That's
the acceptable tip. And do music people tip better? Yes.
Yeah.
Every rock star I went to over-tipped me because I had long hair. And, you know, they over-tipped me, and I still think of them fondly. Some of them have passed, unfortunately.
Nice. I mean, yeah, not nice that they passed.
Yeah, they took good care of me. But it's not David Hasselhoff. You just don't want to laugh at that. Okay. Right.
Well, we got something for you. We got something for you here to say
get
thanks.
An oil change over at Ultimate Tire and Car Care. They're good guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You didn't have to
thank
do
you.
That.
Our good buddy's on next.
Yeah, Eldon Thacker. You're going to definitely want to stick around for that. He's waving at us through the window there and that goofy smile that he has. And you want to check out our website, themusicrowshow.com. Hit us up on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all those great places. And definitely tune in next week.
Reach, what's the other one? Match.com?
Yeah. See you next week.